Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the first episode of Dare Ye Enter the Goblin Cave. Today I have my friend Sam.
Hello.
That is Sam. And we are reading short stories we made today. No prompts provided.
No prompts necessary.
No prompts
necessary.
These
are locally sourced, homegrown short stories. I wrote this bad boy in literally a week.
I'm so proud of you.
One human being besides the two of us even knows about it.
Mm.
So you guys are getting something really fresh. Something really new. I'm excited to read it.
Hear that, all three audience members? We're talking to you. All right. So, as is tradition with my podcasts, we're going to roll some dice.
Oh, shit.
To see who ends up reading first. But, of course, we'll end up shooting the shit for a couple minutes.
All right.
Pick wisely. Choose odd or even.
What does that mean? There are many dice in front of me. Do I pick an odd number?
Pick your favorite die.
I'm going to pick this nice little d20.
I'm calling evens.
I'm calling odds.
You would.
10.
10 it is. So I suppose I'll read first.
All right.
Okay. So Sam.
Mm-hmm.
How has your week been?
Oh, my week's been great. You know, I just got back from a nice little vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Bopped down to Texas, saw my girlfriend's family, checked out Houston Space Center, checked out downtown Austin.
Did you dab in front of the... No?
All right.
So yes, spaceship?
Story here, man. So last year, Phoenix and I, we do our first like big road trip together.
Mm-hmm.
We drive down to Los Angeles. We hang out with Kylie. You know Kylie, one of the old friends from Starbucks.
Yeah.
And we go down there and we're trying to just find things to do to fill up the whole week. So we go to Disneyland. We go to Universal Studios. We go to the space shuttle they have on display at the Science Center across from University of Southern California. And when we get in there, it is one of the most, and I know I'm a big space nerd, but like one of the most like impressive and effective displays I've ever seen. And it's very simple. You walk into a big aircraft hangar and they just have the shuttle sitting there. But it's huge, right? Like sitting there on its wheels, it's like, you know, 20 feet off, you know, 20, it's an easy 10, 15 feet off the ground, and then the shuttle itself is like 20 feet tall and has the big tail fin. And so you walk in and you're just kind of awed by it. And what made it even more impressive was we were almost completely alone, right? We were in the middle of the day on a work week. Like, most people weren't there. There were a couple kids. But we're standing there at the entryway looking at this shuttle, right? Sort of like a three-quarter view of the front half of the shuttle. And I say, Phoenix, I need you to take my picture. And she takes the camera, and she was already on edge because when we were at Universal Studios, I made the guy pretending to be the Hogwarts Express conductor dab with me.
Oh, shit. All right.
And I run up in front of the space shuttle, and I bust the deepest dab.
Nice.
Dab. I can't even pronounce words.
You nailed it.
The deepest dab I could possibly summon. And the kids
deepest
are...
The dab you could didgeridoo.
I didgeridid it right there.
Nice.
And the kids were very excited. Then these were like, they were like 13, 14 year olds.
Yeah.
And they were very hyped to see a hairy 20 something man just dab in front of the space shuttle. And she takes my picture and I put it on Twitter and everyone loves it.
Nice.
Because I'm that kind of millennial. And the whole time I'm like, the next time we see something like this, this has to just be a tradition now. I have to dab in front of every amazing piece of space hardware we encounter. So we go to Texas. We go to Houston. And the Houston Space Center has adjacent to it the, I forget the name of it, but they call it the Rocket Garden. which is a collection.
Oh, they grow rockets there.
Yeah, that's where they come from. Fresh Sweet. Picked. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I have to ship them down to Florida. No, they have all these cool rockets. They have like a Mercury Redstone. They have an Apollo Little Boy. They have, in a similar hangar, but much larger, a complete Saturn V. And not a replica, a real deal. They built it for like Apollo 18 or something, which of course never launched. And we go in, and I'm hyping myself up, and we get in there, and it's packed with like Asian tourists and like the kind of old men who wear hats that say like world, like Korean veteran.
You're going to say World War II.
Yeah, it's a bit too old. Yeah. I don't think
it don't exist anymore. I'm sorry. Rest in peace, Grandpa.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, but rest in peace, Grandpa. You served your country. We get in there, and I completely chicken out. We get some good photos of the Saturn V, and it's a super fun display, and I love walking around it. The whole thing's laid out on its side, so you get to walk the whole length of it, and the kind of the inner stages are spread out, so you can kind of get in between the stages of the rocket and look at all the inner bits.
Fucking nice.
It's really good, but I didn't dab, and Phoenix was on my ass the whole time of like, you're gonna fucking regret it, you're gonna fucking regret it. And I said, I'm too scared. And eventually we left.
No.
And I regretted it. I always tell people you should live your lives with no regrets.
That's true.
Because I fucked up. I didn't dab at the Saturn V. And when am I going to be in Texas again? Well, possibly next year, but I'm probably not going to go out to the space. Well, no, if I'm in Texas again, I'm going out to the Space Center.
Promise me this. Promise me right now.
I promise.
The next time you're there, you're going to dab twice.
Twice.
Once for that moment then. And once for the God. Past.
Oh, okay.
Or, yeah, for me, whatever.
Yeah, for you.
For Jesus.
Yeah, dab for Jesus. Hey, kids out there, dab for Jesus.
Indeed.
You know, they say the crucifixion was the original dab. This sort of, the yeah, move has changed, it's evolved since then.
But I think it's gotten a little bit better.
Yeah.
Jesus was a pioneer, though.
Mm-hmm. He changed things. You know what Jesus changed? I don't want to get too meta. Storytelling.
Fucking nice transition.
Yeah, thank you.
That's true. He really kicked it up to high gear.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, here on the first episode of Dare Ye Enter the Goblin Cave, we have written stories.
And we're going to read them.
Stories that's gonna be good. About horror and madness, thieves in the night, and sick, dank magic power.
Mine has no magic in it, I should warn you now. If you need magic, listen to Gavin's and then turn it off, because mine has no magic.
I believe yours has a little bit of a fantastical element, though. Something a little bit the darker scale of magic.
Perhaps.
I say
perhaps
we find out.
Perhaps it's left up to the reader's imagination. Or in this case,
imagination.
Fuck.
Yeah, that's where the word comes from. Jesus invented it.
Thanks, Jesus. And actually, it literally does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
Anyways, as the winner of the decidatory dice roll off that you were a part of.
I was there. I confirmed the results.
I'm electing you to read first.
All right. I'm hyped. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I present for your listening pleasure, The Visitant. Let me get a quick sip of tea before we dive in.
I'm going to do some vapes really quick.
Oh. You know what people on podcasts love? Oh, he did a vape dab. People love mouth noises on podcasts.
I think so. You ever heard of ASMRs?
Yeah, that's all mouth noise.
Yeah.
I mean, all talking is mouth noise. Should we do an ASMR version of this?
Dude.
All right. Okay, there was some ado that sort of crept in. But ladies and gentlemen, The Visitant. Look through the sliding glass doors and into the house. Do you see him there? The man in the brown shirt, sitting down at his table for dinner. His name is Stuart Barrett. He lives here in this squat, cookie-cutter bungalow. Any moment now, his wife should be coming through the kitchen door. You can just see it there to the right. And there she is, right on time. It looks like tonight's dinner is roast beef with a side of green salad. A pleasant meal, if not to my own personal taste. She places the meal on the table, just like always, and he looks up and smiles and says something inaudible. Good old Stuart and Stephanie, a model of suburban bliss. Of course, Jessica, the daughter, is still in her room. It usually takes a couple of shouts from her mother to bring her out, but eventually she comes, just like every night. Oh, Jessica. She's slender and pretty, like her mother. But she's pouting as she sits at the table and has served her food. I'd write it off as a typical teenage fit, but this time Stephanie looks strained, like she wants to reach out to Jessica, but just doesn't know how. It's unusual. Stuart doesn't seem to notice. I see Stephanie's mouth move as if she's saying something, but as I'm hiding behind the bushes in the rear of the garden, I'm simply too far away to hear what. But I can tell that very suddenly the mood of the table has changed. Jessica is staring straight down at her plate. Stuart, typically detached from the dinnertime conversation, looks up from eating, and he says something to Jessica as well. Jessica slams her utensils down. She's angry about something, and I can see her beginning to shout. Stephanie raises her voice back, while Stuart makes a deferential hand gesture. Jessica gets him from her seat, wiping tears from her eyes. She says something once more, and then runs back to her room, slamming the door behind her loud enough for me to hear. Stephanie yells something after her while gesturing with her hand, only to futilely turn to Stuart, as if to ask why he wouldn't back her up. Stuart says something, apparently placative, and goes back to eating. Stephanie sits back down and places her head in her hands. Each night these scenes play out for me like little personal dramas. Of course, I'm never an actor in them, simply the audience. A pale shape hunched in the shadows of the hedgerow, catching glimpses of the lives of others when and where I can. But only in brief. I can't stay out in the open air for too long, you see. It dries out my skin and makes it start to flake and crack. After a while, I must retreat to my true domain, the sewers. Down there, beneath the streets, I have lived for longer than I can truly remember. By and large, it's not a bad living, though I've adjusted to the environment quite nicely. The putrid waters have a way of soothing my skin, and the wasteful suburbanites above provide me with more than enough scraps of nourishment to get by. But right now, I'm still crouched in the shadows of the Barrett's backyard. In the cool fall air, I can fare a little better, but nevertheless, my skin is starting to itch. It's time for me to head home. Quietly, I work my way back to the loose board in the fence, and passing through it, I find myself on the cusp of a familiar line of trees. I walk a small path worn by my own 2 feet, back to a forgotten storm drain. I don't bother to be careful back here, no one but me has been out here for years. I pull the grate off of the drain, and though it's narrow, I squeeze myself back into my home. The air down here is pungent and humid. It suits me. I find a deep pool, and slide myself into it while I reflect on the evening's events. There was a time once when I'd pay visit to other houses on the block. I'd watch as the inhabitants came and went, fought and made up, and lived their lives. I remember the Williams, hollering at each other almost every night. Or the Bowdens, who could fathom why 2 partners so devoted to infidelity would even bother trying to keep up appearances. But by and large, most families weren't that entertaining, and even if they were, it was only sporadic. Most nights it was just a silent dinner, perhaps some television, and then off to bed. I was starting to grow restless, prowling from house to house, desperate for anything to occupy my attention. That is, until my little family moved in. I still remember that night well. The housing development was fairly new at the time, and many of the houses lay empty. I had just climbed up from that same forgotten storm drain, intending to prowl the neighborhood, hungry for something worth my attention. Something to keep me occupied. Immediately, though, I noticed a change. As I stood in the dark, along the long wooden fence that ran the length of the backside of the nearby row of houses, separating the manicured yards from the adjacent woods, I could see shafts of light slipping between the slats of the fence. Lights were on in a new house. Someone had moved in. I hurried to the source of the light. Methodically, I began testing the slats of the fence. Often there'd be a gap or a loose board, anything that I could use to create a makeshift entrance to the backyard. Anything I could use to get a better look. The fencing was new, and the wood was fresh and full of splinters. As I pulled on the boards, they scraped and poked into the papery skin of my hands. I started to bleed, but I didn't care. What small amounts of blood I left behind would never be noticed. And after a few tries, I found a board sufficiently loose as to allow me to pull it back slightly and move it to the side, creating a space just large enough to squeeze my thin body through. I was now crouched behind a newly planted bush, one of several that ran along the fence in the rear of the yard. It wasn't much, but it provided coverage enough that I felt emboldened to peer through the leaves, and that's when I first saw them. The family that I would come to know as the Barretts. It's almost funny looking back on it now. Stuart was thinner, and missing the creeping bald spot on the back of his head. Stephanie looked much the same, only much less tired than her current self. And then there was Jessica. She was very young, only perhaps 2 or 3 years old. Her hair was pale yellow and very curly. And it was long, too, unshaped and slightly wild. Even though I hadn't yet learned her name, there was something about her that instantly fascinated me. In her tiny frame, she somehow carried with her an energy and a purity that challenged the mundanity and selfishness I had seen in the homes I'd observed before. I stayed crouched in the shadows of the backyard for a very long time, completely enraptured. I watched through that big sliding glass door, with no blinds or curtains to obstruct my view, as she ran circles around her parents as they moved boxes in and out of the space that would become their dining room. She didn't care that it was late or that they were exhausted. She was precocious. She was absolutely unlike anything I had ever seen before. It was a warm summer night, and the dry heat of the air was causing my skin to flake and crack. But I didn't care. I couldn't take my eyes off of her. After about an hour of unpacking and moving things around, her parents scooped her up into their arms and carried her off, presumably to be put to bed. The lights in the house flicked out, and in turn I returned to my own dwelling beneath the streets, carefully replacing the dislodged fence board as I left, feeling more alive than I had felt in years. She began to dominate my thoughts. In short order, the Barrett's home became the only place that I visited at night. And why bother with any of the other houses? They no longer had anything to offer me. Everything I needed was right there, with the Barrett's. In time, I grew more brave during my visits. If I timed things right, on moonless nights, I had a great deal more agency to move about the yard once I was on the other side of the fence. I was already very familiar with the layout of things from my previous excursions to other homes, which were all built to the same floor plan. I already knew where the darkest corridors of shadow were, and I already knew which corners of the yard I could stand in without risk being seen from inside the house. I even knew where the air vents were, that just so happened to carry their voices, whether they're in the dining room, the kitchen, or their own bedrooms. I used these vents to learn about the Barretts, who they were and what they did. I learned that Stuart was bored at work. I learned that Stephanie struggled with anxious fits. But at any opportunity I had, I learned more about Jessica. I learned that she was healthy and happy, more or less. That she didn't fuss very much for a child her age. But also that Stephanie was worried about how little she socialized. I learned she was very intelligent, but very active, too. And when the vents weren't enough, I could dig through the garbage cans, recovering bits of mail, scraps of newspaper, anything I could get my hands on. A few times, I brought things back to the sewers with me as keepsakes. The Barretts wouldn't miss them. I was obsessed and desperate for any amount of information that could help me learn more about this family, and anything that could, perhaps, help me feel closer to my precious Jessica. Time went on and I continued my nightly visits to the Barretts, watching Jessica as she slowly grew, and keeping careful tabs on the activity of her family. One night, when Jessica was in grade school, I entered the backyard at my usual time to discover something very unusual. A fourth person was seated at the dinner table. She was a brown-haired girl who looked to be about Jessica's age. How fascinating! Was this a friend from school, maybe? It seemed likely. How nice for Jessica. Perhaps her mother's concerns about her sociability were for nothing. I wanted to push closer. Maybe even get to one of the air vents so I could enjoy their conversation. But with the lights from the dining room illuminating much of the backyard, I had no way of doing so. So I satisfied myself with waiting and watching. Jessica and her friend seemed to be having fun, and Stephanie and Stuart were doing a good job of playing the role of gracious host. After a short while, dinner was done and Jessica left the room with her friend as her parents began to clean up. After the dining room was sorted, Stuart and Stephanie themselves left the room, turning the lights off behind them. As the light in the living room went off, I immediately noticed a new light shining into the side yard. That was the light from Jessica's room. Was she still up? Normally she would be put to bed after dinner. Now that the yard was dark, my curiosity got the best of me. I crept up to the air vent connected to Jessica's room, and held my head to the grate. I could hear Jessica talking to her friend, whose name I overheard was Emily. Had Emily not gone home? Was this a sleepover? What an exciting first for Jessica. I maneuvered myself into the side yard to get a better look. Through Jessica's bedroom window, I could see her and Emily as they laughed and played. Truly, it warmed my heart to see her so happy. I felt once again that same sense of enrapturement that I had known the first night I ever saw my Jessica. Without realizing it, I had been drawing ever closer to the window. My face was nearly touching the glass now, well illuminated by the lights from her room. I was being stupid. I had gotten sloppy. I wasn't being careful anymore. She had drawn me in so deeply that I had forgotten the rules of the game. All it took was a slight turn of her head and she had spotted me. Could you imagine my pale visage peering into your home? My waxen skin, my thin, wide mouth, my sunken, beady eyes framed by a few wispy strands of oily hair. I've seen myself reflected back in the waters of the sewers. I know that I am not beautiful. She did what any child would do in such a situation. What anyone would do, really. She began to scream. I had to leave quickly. Luckily, only Jessica had seen me. This could easily be dismissed as a childhood flight of fancy, but only if I could make a clean escape. I made my way out of the yard, carefully replacing the dislodged slat so as not to arouse suspicion, and nearly sprinted back to my storm drain. I threw my long body down the wide drain pipe and replaced the cover. Once again, I was home. Once again, I was safe. For the rest of the night and throughout the next day, I could not sleep. My thoughts raced. For the first time, I was distinctly aware of my dissatisfaction with simply watching Jessica. I realized that I wanted something more. Over and over again, I obsessed over the mistakes I had made. The sloppiness, the mindlessness. But truly, my biggest mistake had been allowing myself to believe, even for a moment, that I could actually be a part of Jessica's life. But why shouldn't I be? Aren't I the one that has dedicated myself to watching over her? And why should she be the one to reject me on the basis of my appearance? Why should anyone? Why should I be the one creeping through the shadows, rather than her distant father or her anxious mother? I care for her in ways they could not. As different as we may seem, I understand my Jessica. I could raise her just as handily as Stuart or Stephanie, if not better for the depth of my affection. That nightfall, I returned to the Barrett's house. At first, I told myself not to bother, but as was becoming the norm, young Jessica got the best of me. I couldn't help myself but to go and check on her. Once again, I entered their yard. Dinner was already in progress when I arrived, but things seemed a bit different. Jessica, normally lively and excitable, was unusually demure. Stuart, of course, took no mind, but Stephanie looked worried. They ate in silence, and when the meal was done, Jessica retreated to her bedroom. I waited until it was safe, and then I cautiously approached the air vent. I didn't dare expose myself in one of her windows again. Through the vent, I could faintly hear Jessica crying. I suppose it served her right. I opened my eyes. I'm still in that deep pool near the storm grate. I must have slept for some time, however restlessly, dreaming myself back to that night in the Barrett's yard. Even now, years later, it still consumes me. But it hasn't lessened my devotion to Jessica. Reject me as she did, I still feel obligated to watch over her. In truth, I know I couldn't stop myself from doing so if I tried. She is now, as she was then, my complete obsession. I look up towards the metal grate, and I can see the orange glow of late afternoon. It'll soon be dark again. I'm anxious to get back to the Barretts and perhaps get a clue of what was going on when they fought last night. But in the meantime, I am hungry, so I begin to wade through the sewers in search of a bit of refuse. You know, it's been years since that night, but I still overhear her talking about it sometimes. At first, she tried to tell her parents, but as I suspected, nothing really came of it. Stuart, of course, dismissed it out of hand, though he did become more diligent about checking her closet for monsters at night. Stephanie, likewise, didn't really believe her, but at least encouraged her to talk about it. Eventually, the two of them were able to convince her that the whole thing had just been her imagination. Jessica even started having sleepovers again after a while, even going so far as to feature me as the antagonist when it was her turn to tell her friends a scary story. She was very creative. She described my face as coming out of the dark, looking like a mix between a corpse and a frog. It doesn't feel good to be mocked. By now, night had fallen, and it was time for me to return to my spot behind the bushes in the yard. But I had spent too much time foraging in the sewer, I'm late for dinner, and it's nearly finished by the time I arrive. As the table is cleared, I start planning my path towards the air vents. Perhaps I can at least grab a few fragments of conversation. But as the light in the dining room turns off and I begin to move, I freeze, and I hear something coming from the side yard. I hear the sound of a window unlatching, and I can hear Jessica whispering something. Moving quickly but quietly behind the bushes, I get to the far left corner of the yard, where my view of the side will be unobstructed. I make it just in time to see a teenager, a boy roughly Jessica's age, maybe 16 or 17, helping her to climb out of her bedroom window. The same bedroom window she had seen me in all those years before. They kiss briefly, and the boy helps her to climb back over the fence toward the street before climbing over himself. For a moment I stand there paralyzed. The scene I just witnessed has cut me deep. Was this the source of the drama from the night before? Some boy? Her parents must have disapproved. It would explain why she was sneaking around at night. How stupid of her! Doesn't she know how dangerous it is to go wandering off in the night with strange men? Clearly her parents were right to be suspicious of his intentions. I have no way of following them. The streets themselves are too well lit. There's nothing I can do now but wait until they return, or return to my own sewer. If I linger here for too long, it's entirely possible they'll detect me on scent alone by the time they get back, and besides, the air is a bit dry tonight and I'm already starting to itch. Defeated, confused, and hurt, I slink out of the yard and crawl back to my home. I have been through so much with Jessica over the years. Her successes, her failures, her fears and hopes. Even if only in secret. Even if only as a watchful eye in the shadows, I was always there for her. When Stuart didn't care or Stephanie was in the middle of one of her neurotic episodes, I was there with her. But now she's throwing herself at this strange boy like a childish idiot. I suppose part of me should have known this day would come. She's getting older and has good prospects for college. This couldn't have lasted forever, but now that it's ending, I refuse to accept it. Not like this. But it's futile. What could someone like me even do? The best course of action is obviously no action at all. I'll keep visiting the Barrett's house and watching them just like normal. I'll make the best of this. I find a comfortable spot, and I lay down to rest. The persistent dripping and gurgling of the slow-moving water lull me to sleep. The next night comes, and with great difficulty I convince myself to climb back up the storm drain. My heart is no longer in it, but I figure I may as well go through the motions. I walk down the path to the Barrett's rear fence once more. I find the loose board and once again dislodge it just enough to grant access to the backyard. I crawl through the opening. The backyard is dark. Oh well, they must have just had an early dinner tonight. In a sense, I'm relieved. Despite my rest the previous day, I feel tired. But just as I'm turning to leave, I hear something from the side yard again. Another midnight meeting? But this time there's no whispering, just a brief clatter, like two shoed feet dropping onto concrete. Jessica promptly rounds the corner, but alone this time. She's squinting in the dark like she's trying to find something. Though she does not see me behind the bush, I can see her quite well. She looks angelic and delicate, clearly dressed to go out. Without thinking about it, I shift my left foot slightly, and a twig snaps beneath it. Her head snaps to face me. Shit. John? She calls out quietly. She doesn't seem scared, more likely that she just doesn't want to wake her parents. You're late, she laughs. You were supposed to be here at 8. I was getting worried. She takes a step towards me. Clearly, she can just about make out something crouched behind the bush, but can't tell who or what it is yet. I'm completely out of options. There's just enough moonlight in the yard that she'd see me if I made a break for the fence. My heart is racing. I'm paralyzed. All I can do is wait. She's drawing very close now. John, did you step in something? You smell off. And just then, a stiff breeze shifts the branch covering my face and our eyes meet. I can see the terror crawl over her face as she instantly recognizes who it was behind the bush. Suddenly, I'm back at the night in her window when she saw me for the first time. Suddenly, I'm filled with the same rage and shame and humiliation that I felt then. I have devoted my life to this woman. I know everything about her, and she doesn't even know I exist. I have cared for her, yet she cannot even bear to look at me. I barely even realize that I'm now standing over her. She starts to scream, but I can hardly hear it. In a flash, my hands are at her throat. This stupid, selfish girl who'd rather run around at night with some boy, reject a lifetime of commitment, who would be so weak and vain as to fear me for my appearance. I was a fool. I was wrong to love her for so long. She did not deserve it, and in truth, I hate her. She's no different than anyone else in this miserable neighborhood. I hate who she is, and I hate what she represents. The delicate skin of my fingers is cracking and rubbing away with the force I'm applying to her neck. She's struggling hard and clawing at my face and wrists, and though I can see my blood running down my arms and chest, I'm not bothered by it. I'm lifting her off the ground now. She's trying to kick me, but I can feel her growing weak. I look at her face, beet red with asphyxia. Her eyes are clamped shut and her lips are pulled back in a terrible grimace. Even now, she mocks me. She won't even look at me. She wants me to know how truly revolting she thinks I am. With all of my strength, I slam her against the ground, and with a loud crack, her head makes contact with the edge of the concrete patio. Just then, the lights in the dining room flick on, and I can see Jessica's body bathed in their yellow glow. She's gone silent and is no longer resisting me. In fact, she's not moving at all. Her neck is a half-crushed mess of bruises, painted red with the blood from my palms. Her face is relaxed now, but its color is quickly draining as a pool of blood starts to form around it on the faux-tiled floor of the patio. I look up to see Stephanie standing in the frame of the sliding glass door. I'm not sure she realizes what she's looking at. Her face is a mixture of terror and confusion. And then realization sets in. She screams as I let go of her daughter's body and run back towards my hole in the fence. Before I know it, I'm back down my storm drain, letting the putrid waters of the sewer soothe my wounds. I wonder if Stephanie remembers Jessica telling her about me. I wonder if she remembers convincing Jessica that I wasn't real, that I wasn't anything to be worried about. And I wonder if she thought about that when she saw me in the backyard, bloodied and crouching over her dear, sweet daughter. I can hear the sirens of police cars above me now. I'm not worried. Even assuming Stephanie is foolish enough to tell them what she truly saw, what are the chances of them believing her? I'm entirely unlike anything any of them has ever seen before. They'll sooner write it off as female hysterics than believe a creature like me exists. No, this'll probably get pinned on that boyfriend of Jessica's, whatever his name was. A violent boyfriend, especially one that the parents already disapproved of, is a much easier pill for society to swallow. Stephanie will know the truth, of course, but in time maybe she too will convince herself that I was just a figment of her imagination, a phantasm imposed on her psyche as she struggled to deal with the scene she was taking in. That said, this neighborhood is now ruined for me. Even with my scapegoat, there'll still be rumors. People will be leaving their lights on, looking twice in the shadows, checking to see if that figure moving in their peripheral vision was just their imagination after all. It won't be safe for me any longer. Any more sightings and I'll become a local legend. Luckily for me, these sewer tunnels stretch for miles. I can just slip away and follow the flow of water to some new town with a new neighborhood full of new families. And maybe, just maybe, I'll find someone more deserving of my devotion than Jessica ever was.
Oh my god. Someone like you, listener.
He could be in your town.
Jesus. The way you narrated that one.
Uh-huh.
Like, it was first person. You were behind this creature the whole time. And you gave him such, like, an energy. Such, like, a, like, happy, interesting energy. But he was this awful, disgusting creature.
Thank you.
That was disturbing for me to listen to.
I'm glad. That's what I was going for. I realized halfway through I wasn't writing a ghost story so much as a gross story.
Yeah. That was beautiful, man. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much. I had a lot of fun writing it.
All right. One swig.
Knock him dead.
Yeah. Well done, though. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
Fade in. The celestial and omnipresent third eye of the reader opens to see night. Night far above a vaguely peanut-shaped landmass. There, you dip low, rushing through clouds and cold, disturbing an aerial formation of blue songbirds. Did they see you? No. Perhaps they simply reacted to the shifting of the wind. Down below you is the great and bustling city of Moon Lake. In the large stone manor, on not but the most lofty of hills, is the governor's house. You peer in through the upper window. Through the yellow candlelight you see Mayor Faridin. He was sitting in his office chair. He was a portly man, with a big, honest grin and a sparse black beard. He poured himself a third glass of fortified goblin wine, then spoke to his secretary. Any news of the caravan? Yes, sire. They will arrive in just a few hours. Then we must act quickly. Did you send an envoy with my offer? Yes, sire. But the mages declined. They say all the gold you offer is meaningless to the eyes of their mage god. But I offer them 1,000 bloody currency for that dusty tome. I know, sire. I even offered an additional 500 for my own to sweeten the... I did not hire you to interfere with negotiations. Know your place, peasant. Faridin interrupted. The secretary mumbled with a meek, Yes, sire. The secretary was a tall and thin man, with a pale and hollow face, had about as much spine as a jellyfish and none of the charm. Mayor Faridin drummed his fingers on the half-empty bottle while dredging his wretched mind for answers. Moon Lake City was a hive of activity, from the tall buildings stretching out into the shallow waters to the marketplaces in the highlands. It was always active. Even in the dead of night, the lights from all the taverns was more than enough to find your way through the city. One such tavern was the Slammin' Salmon, a rough scene to say the least. Here, the Brotherhood of Nicken, TM, operated in the open. These men were professional thieves. They would steal anything from purses and coin sacks to horses and rare gems, including an election that one time. There was one rogue among them, a goblin man named Verdi. He was a thief, with a drug addiction and ambition to match. He would steal anything and everything, even your heart, if you gave him a chance. He was short, though, a mere 1 foot 9 inches tall, with a big crooked nose and 2 gleaming yellow marbles for eyes. And on this night, he was at the Slammin' Salmon, looking for the next easy target or high-paying job to walk through that door. Here you zoom in on the stained and well-battered door. It is pushed open by the mayor, trying in vain to disguise himself with a cloak three sizes too small, and his hauntingly rat-like servant. They paused a moment, after they entered, to look around, while Verdi eyed them and sipped from a tankard that was oh so slightly larger than his head. The two noblemen, noble in quotations, spotted the goblin, sitting at the table marked Brotherhood of Nicken Table, TM, and made their way over. "So, I've never done this before," said the servant. "That's what your mom said when Verdi fucked her," said the goblin. "Enough. We need your expert services," the mayor said discreetly as he could. "You need Verdi to fuck his mom?" the goblin said inquisitively. "No, you fool. We need you to..." The servant was cut off. "Not so loud, boy," the mayor shushed the lad. "Secrecy," he continued, tapping his nose twice and giving the servant a sly wink. "You need Verdi to steal some shit?" the goblin explained with a horrendous and sardonic grin that only a magic goblin man could muster. The mayor looked around nervously and began to stand up. "Come on, it is obvious he is not serious." "No, no, no, come back. Just tell Verdi what you want and how much you are paying." The mayor secretively relayed details of the book and the promise to pay the goblin 700 currency for it, conveniently leaving out the fact that it be guarded by an order of dark magi. The goblin agreed, and they paid him 50 coins up front. Verdi stepped under the table and was gone within seconds, out chasing his mark. Then the mayor and the servant walked over to a representative of Boys Who Stab, the local assassin clique, and grinned evilly, paying the man a full 200 currency. Verdi rushed over the rooftops, dashing through the icy midnight wind. His black cape flowing behind him, he could hardly be seen. He leapt from building to lamppost to other building, silently, until he came upon the mage's caravan. They had stopped directly outside the house of a well-known nobleman, and apparently all gone inside. Verdi looked at the marks on the wagon side, trying to decipher what he saw. It was written in a language unfamiliar to him, Elvish, perhaps. So he shrugged, and peered into the largest wagon, hoping it would have that stupid book. He found, instead, two men inside the wagon, dressed quite similarly to himself. The goblin held himself to the wagon's window, watching the black-garbed human pace. The human tasked with unloading the kegs of wine and bringing them inside was talking to his comrade. "I can't believe they uncovered that ancient book of demon power." "Yeah, I can't wait to become a powerful warlock like Sir Eridurin." "Yeah, let's get this wine inside too. Can't have a blood ritual without booze, 'cause you know how red wine fools demons into thinking it's virgin blood or something?" He tapped his nose twice and gave a sly wink to his comrade in magic, and they began carting off the kegs to the house. Verdi turned to look at the house. The path was far too long and well lit, and the neighbors' houses were just a little too far away to jump from. All of this was quite unfavorable terrain for Verdi, so he climbed into the wagon, dumped a barrel of wine out the window, and ducked himself into it, replacing the lid from the inside. He waited, patiently, and eventually, the warlocks did return. "Hey, let's use that demon magic to lift the barrels onto the cart." "Nah, man, you know there's a 50% chance they'll just obliterate those barrels and send the wine into a demon's belly." "Yeah, but fuck rules. Why do you even become warlocks if we weren't going to abuse our power?" The goblin began to panic. "What if he never got to use magic drugs again? Fuck, fuck, fuck. Oh no, not a demon's belly," thought the goblin to himself as the barrel began to shake violently. He settled on the knowledge that a demon would end up with all his horrible worms and was satisfied with the knowledge that his death might bring eternal suffering for a far eviler being. He didn't die, though. Instead, the violent quaking gave way to the low rumble of wheels on a gravel pathway. The beating of drums and low horns grew louder as he approached the house. The goblin heard voices and could smell human. He could tell there were 12 people here. The goblin had a gift when it came to his nose. 2, he knew, would be unloading more goods from the cart. 2 would be guarding the outside of the front door. 3 were playing music. 1 was on the balcony staring up to the night sky like an angsty warlock. 3 were gathered together in the foyer next to the wine casks. And 1 was all by his lonesome, somewhere deeper in the house. The goblin thought that the lone warlock would be his best bet. Once the 2 irresponsible cartwheelers placed the cask with the others and left, Verdi saw his chance. He cracked open the back of the barrel cask and slithered out. Once free the barrel's moist confines, he slinked behind a table, hiding in the shadows cast by the warlock's own candles. They each held a candle in one hand, and talked together about the demon book and other warlock things. If Verdi had known it was warlocks, he would have charged double. But nonetheless, he was in and he was going to get that book. He snuck under the table and crawled right under the chair where the warlocks were sitting, then let out a silent, but nasty, goblin fart, causing a scene as the warlocks covered their faces and gagged. Verdi slipped away into the darkened halls. We both had smelly little stealth experts.
Huh.
Yeah.
That is quite an observation. We totally did.
Yeah. Verdi slipped away into one of the darkened halls. It was lined with all manner of alchemy books and magic books, and books in Spanish or something else he couldn't read. On the shelves were sweet demon runes and a human skull covered in red claw marks. Verdi was getting lost, thinking about which book. But then he sensed the lone warlock in a room up ahead and to the left. Verdi quietly scuttled along the ground till he came to the room where the warlock sat, cross-legged, floating just a few inches above his bed, meditating. The book was on an altar at the foot of his bed. Verdi had closed in, crawling up close to the altar. Closer and closer he crept, till one slimy goblin hand reached out for the book. But before he could grab it, the warlock dropped to the bed and gasped for air. The goblin quickly scurried off, his little heart beating so fucking fast. The warlock collected himself, and the book, and strutted out to the main hall. Fuck, fuck, no, fuck, the goblin thought to himself. He had to think fast, so he dashed under the warlock's flowing cloak and kept pace, walking grapevine style between his legs and carefully dodging the warlock's evil balls, which bobbed up and down with each step. Eventually, the warlock stepped up some stairs to the pedestal in the lobby. Verdi could smell all the other warlocks had gathered and began toasting with wine. The owner of the cloak Verdi was hiding under spoke. Time to get some more dank powers! Everyone cheered.
Woo!
Like tricking girls into wanting to kiss us with our bad magic.
I'm sorry.
Everyone cheered again. And making cool rings with smoke magic. Everyone cheered again. And mind controlling everyone in the city to elect me mayor. Everyone cheered a fourth time. Sir Erdoran, the warlock, plopped the magic book down on the pedestal and began speaking more about the evil shit he was going to do with it. But Verdi saw his opportunity and took it. He leapt up onto the pedestal, grabbed the book, farted in the warlock's face level, and jumped away. Up and across the table he ran, dropping one smoke bomb as warlock guards were caught off guard. They quickly cast dark sight on themselves, though, and began preparing a variety of murder spells. The goblin did some sweet acrobatic flips through the air and landed on the back of one of the door guards, who had a spell prepared in his right hand. The goblin slid down the warlock's arm, angled it at the other guard, and pressed down on the warlock's extended thumb, shooting the other guard with a turn-you-inside-out spell. A warlock shot at the goblin, but missed and hit the guard instead, causing him to be filled up with snakes until he exploded. It was gross. The goblin ran, and kept running, but magic lasers and fire shrieking by him as he did so, till he took a sharp right into an alleyway. He waited for the angry mob of warlocks to spread out some, and then he climbed onto the roof, looking back to the slammin' salmon, when he smelt the presence of another human behind him on the rooftop adjacent. The human shot a barbed poison arrow at the goblin, but the goblin was far too tiny to hit, and quickly skittered into a chimney hole, bracing each arm and leg against its four walls. The human crept over to the chimney hole, peered down it, definitely not expecting the goblin to pop up and kick him in the face. The assassin staggered backwards in pain and fell off the roof. The goblin went to check if there was body he could loot, but found none. So he decided to hightail it to the tavern. He came in through the doors to find his table empty. He went and sat down, his drink still there, and as he went for a victory swig, three tall humans, clad in armor, clad again in incognito brown robes, pulled out their swords and pointed them at the goblin. Stop right there, you little stinker. We got you red-handed. The goblin looked around, seeing all manner of undercover guardsmen. The guard captain, a tall man with a thick jaw and nasty scar across his right eye that went down and connected to the corner of his mouth, his sparse gray hair pulled out of his good eye, spoke. We got a report that a thief's been stealing books, so we gotta confiscate that and your weapons, and you're coming with us. The goblin frowned and slowly placed a sick dagger with skulls on the hilt on the table. The captain said, all your weapons. The goblin rolled his eyes and placed two more small daggers on the table, then gave a dumb look to the guard, who then grabbed the goblin by the ankles and shook him over the table until eight more small daggers, a grappling hook, a meat cleaver, a few smoke bombs, and a picture of the servant's mom in a heart-shaped locket fell from a variety of secret pouches and such. Then the book. The guards packed it all into a bag and began escorting the little figure to the dungeon, his hand shackles with shackles specially designed for orphan children. The goblin trudged along, loudly exclaiming his discomfort, when from the shadows the warlocks had caught up. They came forth from an alleyway in front and behind the arresting train. The leader spoke. Give us back the book. It's ours. And flexed his wizard muscles. Sorry, bud, but that's evidence. And the law says we gotta... The warlock cut him off by firing a laser into the captain, melting a portion of his armor with demon acid. And soon there was an all-out battle. Warlocks were fucking firing dope low-level magic at the guards, like fireballs at snakes till you explode curse.
It's my favorite curse.
Yeah. And the guards were deflecting fireballs with their shields and exploding inside their armor, but also fucking stabbing warlocks like crazy. The guard captain cut a warlock from head to taint in one swing from his murdering sword. The goblin easily slipped free from those shackles and approached the pile of snakes and armor that all his swag was in. Carefully, he stepped over an incredibly confused and wet snakes, and thief grabbed the bag without anyone noticing, save for the assassin who watched from a rooftop far away. The goblin sneaks out into the city with the assassin hot on his tail. Sometime later, the mayor is pacing around with his servant in the room, who is fetching yet another bottle of goblin wine, when the servant hears a tap on the window and goes to investigate. It's the goblin. You! Shrieked the servant. Verdi! He farts and scurries over to the mayor's room. The mayor is standing proudly at his desk. You have the book? The goblin smirks. You set a trap for Verdi. I did no such thing. Yes, you did. You nearly killed Verdi. Heh. Well, you're alive. Now where's the book? You're a snake. Yes, I am. Now where's the book? You'll never get that book. Oh yeah? The mayor reaches behind a desk and pulls out a triple crossbow and levels it at the goblin. Where's the book, you little booger? Verdi rolled into a fat joint, and Verdi smoked all the magic, and he shoots that snakes till he explodes spell at the mayor, causing him to, you know...
explode into snakes.
Yeah. Servant, bring me your mother, shouted the goblin. And as an epilogue, the goblin killed the mayor and became the new mayor, because that's how this backward society works. Then he marries the servant's mom, and they have nasty goblin sex in every room of the office. The warlock master wanted to have an election to instill democracy into the city he loves, but the goblin has him burnt at the stake for witchery, lighting the fire, of course, with his own magic. The guards then worked in conjunction with the thieves' guild, and they all got hella rich. The end.
Yay!
God, I was able to make it through that.
You did. You did a good job reading. I liked the voices you did. I liked, have you ever read, I think it's called Board of the Rings? It was like some National Lampoon guys in the 70s who did a parody of Lord of the Rings?
No.
Man, that got me thinking about that in a good way. I love me some comedy fantasy. Hey, this is your homework, listeners. Go find yourself a copy of Board of the Rings and give it a read, because it's fun. It starts with a sex scene between Frodo and, is it Gwendolyn is the elf woman from Lord of the Rings?
I'm actually not too familiar with Lord of the Rings, just entirely. I know, I probably should.
You're out here writing good-ass fantasy comedy. You gotta know the roots of the genre.
I gotta listen to the actual roots of the genre. I do love me some good hardcore comedy.
For the listener, he literally held up a copy of Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal.
Okay, this a little political humor, but I'm not signing on to either side of any argument ever, just so everyone knows. I don't have opinions. Don't ask me about them. Anyways, yeah, that was a beautiful episode.
Again, yeah,
I thoroughly enjoyed your story. It was It felt so bad.
Made you feel bad.
Yeah, it made me feel like there's like this, ugh.
That's, I really enjoyed your story too. That was, I know I'd read through the bulk of it before we recorded, but there were still some bits in there that got me going. Like the first time one of the guards explodes into snakes, I get really excited every time. You have a good knack for a line that doesn't have a joke in it, but is just itself very goofy. Like, the three men clad in armor, clad again in stealthy robes. Like, just the way you phrase that, I think is really fun.
I appreciate that. No, I couldn't have done half the stuff without, like, with a decent editor. It's because I write much the same as a third grader. Maybe a fourth grader. But it's not great. Shouldn't read my rough drafts. Special thanks to Kylie, who edited the first half of that story.
All right.
The rest of that was rough draft. So that's the end of the podcast.
We don't have a script yet. We don't have a script yet. We don't have a script yet. So this is the end.
Special thanks to Sam providing all the music for the episode.
You're welcome.
Special thanks to anyone else who decides to provide art or additional music this episode. You will be credited in whatever format this is published on. But as of right now, I don't have anything. Okay. Toodles.
Sayonara.
You survived the Goblin Cave.
Oh, that's a good end. You dared enter the Goblin Cave.